So we are now focusing on, this is really the fifth part of this section called David's Children. And to recap, because I know we haven't had a child, this has been a little bit choppy recently. But just to recap what we've done up till now. David HaMelech, we're now getting into the saga, not so much of David HaMelech's focus on himself, but his children. The first thing we learn about is this: he has his eldest son, his very favorite son, it seems like, Amnon. And Amnon has an issue. Amnon goes and horrifically rapes his half-sister, Tamar. In response to that, Avshalom, who is the direct brother, the blood brother to Tamar, seeing David HaMelech not taking action, goes and assassinates his older brother, older half-brother Amnon, and that leads to a discord between Avshalom and David. Avshalom runs into refuge in his maternal parents' house in Geshur, and David HaMelech is estranged from him. And what happens is that Yoav, David's general, brokers some sort of peace whereby he sends this woman from Tekoa in, and she gives this whole story and convinces David HaMelech that on his own terms and his own logic, he should really bring back his lost son. And that's what happens. David HaMelech brings back Avshalom. The last thing we see is that David HaMelech is not interested in actually engaging in Avshalom. He doesn't really speak to him. There's no real connection. That's what leaves us. So the unit tonight, what we're going to be focusing on is in the shadow of all that. Now Avshalom is back in Yerushalayim. He's back under the shadow of David HaMelech. And what happens during this period of time? This is our challenge. This is our story now. So our focus this evening is going to be moving from Perek Yudalid in Shmuel Beis all to the tail end, all the way through to about halfway through Perek Tesvav. That is our goal for this evening. Let's take a look at this. This is such a really fascinating topic as it happens. Here we go. In the actual psukim, we're going to start. It's Yudalad Chof He to Chof Zayin. First, let's just consider what's actually happening. Here we're told. Uka Avshalom Nahaya Ish Yafeh V'Kol Yisrael Lahalel Ma'od Mikaf Ragloi V'Ad Kod Kodai Lahaya Boy Mum. And Avshalom was a very handsome man. So we're told that there's no one more handsome or praiseworthy than him. From the very palms of his feet until the top of his skull, there was nothing lacking in this man. So he's a very attractive man. And when he would shave his head, he'd do it every year. That's when he would lighten up his hair. It would be 200 stone of the stones of the king. Now, we're not sure the stones of the king were in those days, but it sounds like that's a significant amount of hair, right? And hair is obviously seen as sort of a crown of health, of ruddiness. This is a sign of strength. And this is the kind of locks he takes off on his annual basis. Vayivaldu l'Avshalom shlosha vanim. He has three sons. Uvas achas ushmo Tamar. And he has one daughter whose name is Tamar. He hasa isha yefas mar'eh, and she was a beautiful woman. So it must run in the family. Okay, so this is the first thing that we're told about this. That was just such a strange interlude, because right now we've been talking about Avshalom, his father, his relationship to his father. Now suddenly we start hearing about what he looks like in the mirror. So there's a number of things that we need to think about. Why are we hearing about his beauty? Why are we hearing about his beauty right now? So there are a number of different ways of looking at this. And one is that we could say that this is a description by inflection, which means to say that maybe what's being described is what's not being described. When you say somebody is, you know, very handsome and very attractive, what you could also be saying, and they are not wholesome inside, as an example, meaning to say what's missing, right? You know, physically, we're talking about somebody of beauty, but internally, where's the value? And that might be part of the question that's at stake here. And that's what the Chida actually says. In the first source here, which is source 42, he says, in the actual Hebrew, he says, after the bolded section, Kolomar hagam demitzad shleimus haguf lo hoya kamo yisoy, im kol ze David ha-melech lo hoya yocholi roesa ki ikar David alav ha-shalom hoya mitzakel li shleimus ha-nefesh. So David HaMelech, when he looked at a person, he didn't just see, you know, the make and the year. He looked at the internal part of the person, not just what appeared on the outside. So David HaMelech couldn't look at him because he saw this veneer, this thin veneer of perfection, which was very, very shallowly veiling a corrupt individual inside. And that's what Rabbi Menachem couldn't look at. So the description of Tanakh, in a certain sense, is a, we'll call it a view of, it's painting the picture through absence. That's essentially what's being described here. Yes.
So are they telling us this now as opposed to when they first introduced us to him, because this is what he evolved into?
That's a really good question, because, you know, we never hear about this beforehand. So if we're going to move along with the perspective of the Malbim alone, then it turns out if it's only, as the Malbim says, a description of, you know, sort of his character, then you'd wonder why it wouldn't be earlier, which is a good question, which is what Elisha's raising, which might lead us to maybe there's another reason why this is. I mean, this can't be enough to explain why now in his career we're told this. At the beginning of his career, we should have known this. Why specifically now? So this leads to other Mepharshim. This is precisely this question, which is sort of lacking in the Chida's explanation, leads us to understand that, no, maybe it's critical to right now. The Tanakh is telling us because something now is happening about in Avshalom's life. And what is that? So here's one example. Is that the Radak suggests the reason it's critical to write this moment is the following. If you take a look at the next source, he says, starting from the unembolded section of source 43, he says, Samuch l'sipur hamered shemored ba'aviv siper ma garam loy ze ki yafa yafe v'chol Yisrael loy haya kamahu v'niska'e b'yafyoy uv'sa'ara. The reason it's being described now is because we're now trying to get to a stage of understanding why he rebelled against his father. What was one of those factors that contributed to that mindset was the fact that he felt very full of himself. So he, you know, every day he'd look into his reflection in the river, and he would think what a mighty handsome fellow he is, and what a charismatic leader he would make. And that perspective is what started turning him astray. So, addressing your question, Alicia, so why here? The answer is because it's relevant now, because now it became a factor in his framework of reference. So that's a little bit different to what the Chida is saying. Just a very, very fascinating insight. It should be noted, though, it's interesting, why would anybody be having a haircut once a year? So just those who just walked in, we're talking about Avshalom, we just get a description of his physical beauty. He was a very beautiful man, and he used to cut his hair once a year, and when he cut his hair, there was a whole lot of hair, and weighed a whole bunch of stone, 20 stones. That's a lot of hair. So why is he cutting his hair on an annual basis? He's the prince, after all. He can afford it more often, right? So why is that? Is this the style in those days? And this actually leads us... Great. So this is what the Psikta actually says, the Midrash and Bereishis by Midbar Rabbah actually says that maybe one of the explanations is he is a Nazir. He is a Nazir. And therefore, he was always called a Nazir Olam. He was an eternal Nazir, an eternal Nazirite. Nazirite is a person who's not allowed to engage in three activities, and that is alcohol, hair cutting, and direct contact with the dead. Right? So he was a Nazir Olam, he was an eternal Nazir, and an eternal Nazir doesn't mean to say you can never cut your hair in your life. If you're a Nazir for a particular amount of time, is I'd like to close the door, sorry, just because with all the traffic we're going to get all the... Thank you so much. Thank you. If he's a Nazir Olam, that is, there is a certain limit of time between which he can cut his hair. So this is the annual... He had an annual cycle, and on that annual cycle, that's why he would cut his hair. That's what the Midrash says, which is fascinating, because what is the point of Naziros? What's the point of a Nazirite adopting such a lifestyle? Why would somebody do such a thing like that? So it could be a process of teshuva, but how? So what's the mechanism over here?
Move away from the
gashmi. Right, so a person's moving away from, we'll call, earthliness, you know? You're not going to be permed, you're not going to be look just great, you're not going to be involved in partying and worldliness in the same way, right? So that's the point of a Nazir. What's this Nazir doing? Here is the Nazir, who in a certain sense is finding pride in his Nazirus, right? So like his hair is coming off, and right? So it's the opposite, it's also the corruption of that Nazir. It's fascinating, the Gemara in Nedarim says, talks about the stellar example of a Nazir. It talks about a young man who's walking down to the river one day, and he looks in his reflection, and he says, wow, I am, after all, quite elegant and attractive. That's what, and he looks into the mirror, and the more he looks in the river, the more it looks back at him. And the more he looks back at him, the more he realizes what an attractive young man he might be at parties. And suddenly he steps out of this reverie and he goes and he decides to become a Nazir because he realizes that these kind of thoughts are destructive. So that is where, what was he looking at? Actually, the Gemara says he was looking at his hair. Like he felt like, you know, his hair looked so beautiful. So what was the Nazirus? The Nazirus was the vehicle to be able to sort of contain those kind of thoughts. But ironically, what's happening here? He has the Nazir who his thoughts are, you know, it's corrupting the very process of Nazirus itself. There's something wrong with this cycle, is what we're hearing over here. Moreover, it's actually interesting, in terms of hair, Adina pointed this out a little while back, but in terms of hair, it's ironic that he is so into his hair because ultimately, when Avshalom actually dies, it's because his hair gets caught in the tree, right? It was between haircuts. So that means to say that somehow, the Midrash says, because he was nisga'eh, he was arrogant about his hair, that ultimately was his downfall. We'll see why, you know, obviously didn't mean to say that if he didn't have long hair, he wouldn't have died. But the point is that the vehicle of his death was the same vehicle which led him to his death, which is what it is. So you see just sort of the devolution of the process of a human being. And by the way, it's interesting, when we track this down, and you know, power corrupts and total or absolute power corrupts absolutely, we see a lot of this happening over here in this dynamic over here, which is a sad realization. One thing which I just wanted to also just point out over here is, we don't know his son's names, we do know his daughter's names. What is his daughter's name? It's an amazing thing. I just think without the Mephoshim, classic Mephoshim on the page, not comment on this, but I think that this is the saddest part of this whole story, is that he's living with the ghost of his sister. Think about that. Meaning to say, his sister, the raped sister, Tamar, who he vindicated by murdering his half-brother, was Tamar, and he calls his own daughter Tamar, and she's beautiful. There's something very disturbing about that. That means to say, there's something about his past that he can't let go now, and he's almost living it. She becomes a channel, a vicarious expression of the destroyed life of the sister that he tried to avenge. There's a disturbing cycle over here, because he obviously himself did not find restitution by murdering his half brother. That's what we're seeing over here. But even on his side, forget David Melech's side, he never was able to leave his sister Morton.
Why can't it just be that he was so fond of his sister that you named someone after
it's very possible, and I don't know the customs of the times, you know, so today the Sephardim name after live people and the Ashkenazim name only after dead people. But whichever way the customs are, you know, there are lots of wonderful names and there are lots of wonderful people. It just seems that this is the Tanakh is emphasizing the only child that we know the name of is the one who he's obsessing over, and perhaps rightfully so. Mm-hmm. We can't put ourselves in those shoes, but at the same time, there's something very dark about that.
Aren't you supposed to name a child after someone who died tragically?
Yes. Yeah. Sure. There's certain limitations. There are ways to get around that. Meaning to say, if you add names on, but it does sound like there's something that this connection is the shadow he can't really shake. Anyway, so this is the first thing. So now we've introduced to the Avshalom as a person. Let's move into now his relationship with his father during this period. So this is going to take us from Psukim Chof Ches to Lamed. There's this next little section. By the way, you see we're moving from parasha to parasha, meaning to say we're moving from paragraph to paragraph in the natural delineation of Tanakh. There are extra texts if anyone needs just over here. So here's what the Tanakh tells us. Vayoshev Avshalom Yerushalayim, Shnosayim Yamim, Upnei HaMelech Lo Ra'ah. He stays 2 years in Jerusalem, and he never has court. He never is taken in by the king. And he goes and sends a message to through Yoav, the king's general. Doesn't respond. He sends a second time. You know, the secretary says, "We'll call you. We'll set up an appointment, Avshalom." And there's no response. There's no follow through. So, you know, isn't that Yoav's property over there? He says to his servants, "Why don't you just go light it on fire?" And they go and burn down Yoav's property. Okay, so just a few things over here is on David Melech's perspective, why is David Melech not seeing Avshalom at this point? So even though he allowed him back into town, even though he allowed Absalom to come back to Yerushalayim from his exile in Geshur, somehow that's brought us to neutral. But David HaMelech can't really see love in the son anymore at this point. He can't bring himself to a positive relationship. It's a neutral. It's a very stagnant relationship. There's no way he can get into that. What about Yoav? Yoav over here is not willing to be a messenger, which is funny because Yoav was the messenger. Yoav beforehand was the agent between the two of them who tried to broker the whole deal. So why is Yoav ignoring him right now? Right. So maybe what he's seen is he sees the writing on the wall. He sees that David HaMelech is not coming round. So he knows that it's a futile exercise. So maybe he's saying, I'm not going to engage in this anymore. I've tried to do the best I could. You're here. You're alive. You're not being persecuted. That's enough. Right. And that seems to be where he's leaving it. That's what the Malbim says. He says that, He says, no, I've expended my bank account when it comes to David in this respect. I can't socially, I don't have enough emotional credibility with David HaMelech to force this issue anymore. I've already used it up by sending that woman in, that Tekoa woman in, to convince David. That already depleted my relationship with him. I can't rightfully do this. So he leaves it off. Sometimes what we say is sheva al ta'aseh. He's, you know, just let it lie. He doesn't do anything. This takes 2 years. What's so fascinating to me over here is you see that Absalom over here desperately needs something. What does he want? He just wants recognition, right? And the irony is that what David HaMelech is not willing to give is perhaps the thing which he needs the most and will ultimately solve the situation. And so many times in fights, this is exactly the point, is we stand on principles and ironically we diffuse the exact fight with the counterintuitive response, the reaching out as opposed to stepping back and digging in. But David HaMelech is not at that point. Especially with the child, because the emotions are complex. We're going to see how much more complex in a second. It's a very sad situation. So we have this terrible standoff, the stalemate. It takes 2 years. And in the meantime, you know, Yoav's field has been burnt down. Now, you may say, you know, that is an interesting way. You know, there are other ways of conveying messages, right? You can do a stand-in. You can have a protest outside. You know, like burning down a field is kind of like a last resort, don't you think? So what you see here is an interesting thing about Absalom, and that is that Absalom seems to accelerate his emotions or accelerate his response to things from 0 to 100 very fast. And this is not the first time we've seen it, because when his sister was raped, what does he do? He goes and kills Amnon. There's no conversation, there's no dialogue, there's no truth reconciliation mission. It's simply he goes and murders him. So there's a dangerous side of Absalom over here. It sounds like he plays and he's fine and everything's all right. He plays ball and then suddenly, boom, off the rails. You know, suddenly there's a disaster happens. And this seems to be a cycle which repeats itself we're seeing in his life. And let's follow on to see further examples of this. So now Yoav obviously now has to speak to him, right? This is definitely one way to get people's attention. And so he in the last psukim of this parak, which is Lamed Aleph to Lamed Gimel, here's what happens. I don't get it. I came home one day, and there was no home, right? So you brought me in. You told me it's going to be good for me here. It's better if I was in Geshur because I'm ignored more here in Yerushalayim than I was actually when I was in exile. If he doesn't like me, if he feels I'm guilty, then kill me. But don't leave me in this stalemate position. He doesn't really apologize for the field, right? So Yoav goes to the king and explains, you know, it's a little bit of a sensitive situation here. And Absalom, and so he has Absalom in. And he prostrates himself very respectfully in front of his father, the king. And kisses him. What, again, by inflection, what does he not do?
Apologize.
David HaMelech does not... Doesn't speak. Yeah, so you haven't got to apologies yet. Even he doesn't even say anything. Isn't that incredible? He doesn't even say anything. That's in this dialogue. Very sad moment over here. As the Malbim says, take a quick look at this Malbim. This is in Pasuk. Let's see if which one I put it over here. Yeah, this is in Source 46. The Malbim says, Vayishak HaMelech L'Avshalom, Gambozeh Hera Shalo Yamlichu. He's going to show him that he's not going to anoint him. Shekfar Kosav Avram Ben Ezra Pashas told us, Shanashika Im Lamed Hu Beyad Oy Bekaseif Beli Yamed Hu Bepeh. Says when you have the word nishika with the word with the letter lamed, and then it is on the hand or it's on the shoulder, but without a lamed it is with the mouth. So he really kissed him on his hand, in a throwaway fashion, as you would a dignitary, a diplomat, an ambassador would come in, in a very cold manner, is what is being described over here. So there's the David HaMelech has again acquiesced to Yoav, but he's not really, his heart is not in it, and he's shown this now publicly to Avshalom. Avshalom knows there's no further conversation. What is interesting is Avshalom's request was, Avshalom again is very black and white about things, right? He says, if I'm guilty, kill me. If I'm not guilty, then love me. David HaMelech doesn't live in that kind of black and white world, right? He doesn't necessarily believe he's guilty enough to kill him, but he doesn't believe he's good enough to love him, right? And David HaMelech is in that middle, and Avshalom can't stand that. He can't live like that. It's either absolutely yes or absolutely no, and David HaMelech is keeping him at a arm's length. So this is the tragedy of where we stand now. So at this point in time, there's a turning point, which is perhaps why the chapter was inserted here. Remember, the chapters actually weren't Jewishly inserted into Tanakh, but it actually is a natural turning point, because now Avshalom now takes a different tack. He doesn't seem to be wanting his father's approval as much, and he now starts moving away from his father as opposed towards to him. So Perek Tesvav, the beginning of the 15th Perek, first 6 Psukim are Vahimach Arei Kain Vayaslo Avshalom Erkav Avosusim VeChamishim Ish Ratzim Lefanov. He starts now. He gets his own car service, his motorcade. Right, he has people running ahead of him. By the way, do you know what that must look like? Having 50 people run ahead of you in the chariot. Imagine that somebody like that walking down the street. I mean, that makes some diplomats in Washington look shabby compared, if you think about what that's a very serious entourage. So what he did, he set himself up at the gate, and anybody who came to the king for some sort of, adjudication, for a court case, and Avshalom would turn to him, to this person, he says, so where did you come from? I came from where it is, a village ABC. He says, you sound like a genuine kind of guy. You sound like a genuine kind of person. I don't think you're going to really have a ear in the court of the king. Now, ironically, sometimes when you listen to people, you actually hear their own story reflected in the way they talk to everybody else. What he really was saying is, I don't have an ear in the court of the king. And he's projecting his own lack of relationship onto all these people. Isn't that interesting? So you can hear his own pain expressed in the slander he's making for David. And was David HaMelech not willing to listen to other people? No. David HaMelech was a good king. We have no reason to doubt David HaMelech's ability as a judge. But what he's doing is taking that, and there's something so true about this. I've so many times seen people who criticize something, and then you realize years down the line that it wasn't the victim who deserved the criticism, but it was the criticizer who had something in their lives which was their perennial hotspot. That was their perennial issue, which they criticize in everyone around them because it's their issue. This is what he's doing. He says, nobody's going to listen to you. It's like, listen, I just got my certificate in judging. I'm a good arbiter. I should be a fantastic mediator, good prices. You just sit down right here and I can take you. So he was, in a certain sense, siphoning off. People would come to the court of the king. And whenever anybody would give him his hand, he'd grab that and put him in and kiss him. Again, what's he doing? He's making up for sort of like all the coldness of his father. He's now inserting into this relationship. And he'll do this to everybody who came for judgment. And he stole the heart of Israel. Because you can imagine, the kind of people who go into court are the kind of people who, you know, have issues big enough to have to go to the king for. So these are obviously people who are not, you know, your newspaper delivery men necessarily. And so there's something that he has this charismatic sort of perspective. He's this person who people like. He's very warm to people. He's very convincing to people. And suddenly everybody's coalescing around him. And so what is interesting over here is like what created this change in Avshalom himself? Like, what? Why suddenly? This is a little bit of a different perspective, right? What changed?
His father.
Right. I think he, at a certain point, he says it's a dead end. I'm trying. I'm knocking my head against this brick wall. It's not working. My father's not willing. He's not even going to kiss me. They're not willing to treat me like a son. And this is where things fall through.
I think it's his vanity and his ego that gets in his way. Because if he went to his father apologetically, and if he really cared that he had hurt his father, but it's all about him.
It's true. Listen, you know, it takes two to tango, so it's you know, everybody needs to take that first step, and nobody's ever willing to. But at the same time, I agree with you. Sometimes when your expectation of self or expectation of honor of self is so high, it's very hard for anybody to do anything right. So it's very sad. This is a very sad situation here. Yeah.
I think he did take the first step because he really made effort to go see his father, but he didn't apologize. I think he just wanted to be loved.
Yeah. So I think both perspectives are 100% true. And in fact, when later on we're going to see in David HaMelech's own perspective of his son and his relationship to his son, we're going to see both of those in David HaMelech, where he sees on the one hand the son who's still his child and this nefarious, this terrifying person.
Maybe we need to learn something from this.
100%, that's why it's written.
Because we live in a world today that you love in spite of, not because of.
Yep. There's a lot to learn from here. There's a lot to learn. It's a lot about, you know, who takes the first step.
And your own child is nefarious.
It's very hard. The whole thing, either way. I want to add one level of just sort of what makes it even more complex, and that is the following. Take a look at this. This is just a very sad extra dimension here. Take a look in Source 47. This comes from Shmuel Beis Perek Yud Ches. Later on, a few prokem down the line, we're told the following. Avshalom lokach loy vayatzev loy b'chayav es matzeves asher be'emek hamelech. He took for himself some sort of burial plot while he was alive in the Emek HaMelech, in the Valley of the King, which today is, where is that? Harazesim, just as you go down from the Shara Ashbot, as you leave the old city of Jerusalem, just by the gate right by the Kotel, and you go down that valley, that's called, that is Emek HaMelech, that's the bottom of the Shara Zesim. Ki Omar, he says, Ein Livein, I don't have a son, Ba'avur Hizkir Shemi, who should continue my name. And he gave the memorial, this structure, a name, on his own name. Yad Avshalom Ad Hayom. It is called the Yad Avshalom until today. Now, by the way, that actually, if you take a look at the cover over here, that is actually the picture on the cover over here, is the alleged Yad Avshalom. You can go visit it today. I have visited it today. If anybody's had a chance to go down to the bottom of Harazesim, there are two very large structures. One is Yad Zechariah the Kohen in the first temple, and much earlier is the Yad Avshalom. Now, what is interesting about this is there is a problem in this pasuk, and that is,
says he has no son,
but he had three sons, right? What happened to the children? So here you see something interesting. Obviously, between Perek Yudalad, which you just read, and Perek Yurches, they died. He lost three sons. Because he has no, he had three sons, but there was no son to be remembered by. So therefore, that's why he creates the Yad Avshalom, why he creates this crypt, essentially. Which is fascinating. So says the Malbim, a very sad point. Take a look in source 48. Vayashav Avshalom Yerushalayim, shnasayim yomim, v'pnei ha-melech lo ra'ah. And he didn't see the king for those 2 years. V'lo bo ha-melech l'nachmo al misas benov. Says the Malbim, if you read this all with a bigger perspective in mind, that means to say that even during the period when he lost his own sons, the grandfather of those children wouldn't come to visit. That's how deep that valley was. V'hine is the orer osoy shenis al mer el hamered shera sinas hamelech alav ad shelo haya makom shedavid yamlich osoy. And he realized at this point in time that this was one of the contributing factors to the fact that he should rebel, because if David Melech would not even come to his own grandchildren's funerals, then and to Nechum Avelim, then there was no chance that he was ultimately going to be accepted back in the fold. That's another, we're called, bigger perspective suffering which is going on internally. Almost in a certain sense, what the Tanakh is also emphasizing is in his very rebellion is the wish of the things he could have got from his father, which was the listening ear and the kiss, which are the two things he just so wanted. But he's expressing it in the way he rebels from his father, which really shows us the tragedy of the situation itself, which is terrible. And now listen to what he does. Then this will be our closing foray today. So we're going from Psukim Zion to Tess right now. And here's what happens. He says, Vayihi miketz arba'im shana, it was after 40 years, Vayimar Avshalom HaMelech, El chono v'ashalem es nidri asher no darti la'ala Hashem b'chevron. He says, you know, I made a oath to go to Chevron, to the beginning of your monarchy there. Ki neider nadar avdecha b'shifti b'gishur ba'aram le'mor, yashuv yishiveni Hashem Yerushalayim v'avarti es Hashem. I made an oath that if I would be brought back, I would go to Chevron and pay up whatever it is, bring a korban, do something, right? Vayomer la'amelech, lech b'shalom, go in peace. Vayakom vayelech Chevrona. And he goes off to Chevron. Just a basic thing over here is...
Who tells him to
go? So Avshalom is asking permission from David HaMelech to go to Chevron. And he says, why? Because he has this backstory. When I was in Geshur, I was so desperate to come back. I said, if I come back, I would do this. Now, what does it mean to say that for 40 years? You know, there's different opinions as to what this can mean. So the Malbim says that there's two possibilities. Here's what he says. We'll take a quick look at this Malbim. It's in source 50. He says, Pirush Chachameinu Zichronem Livracha, in the unembolded section, Miyom Sheshalu Yisrael Lohem Melech. It was 40 years from the time that the Jewish people asked for a king, which means including Shaul HaMelech's reign and including David HaMelech's reign up till now in the seven first year, so it's pretty early on in the stage. Va'amari, that's the Rav Yosef Karab, says, Pirush Arba'im Shana Shel Malchus David. Ritzolamar Karav L'Sof Harba'im. It's 40 years into David HaMelech's rule. David HaMelech only did rule for 40 years, which means it's towards the very tail end of David HaMelech's rule. David HaMelech is really at the end of his tenure of kingship. Why is he going there? What's this whole business? Why is he going to in this direction? So Rashi says a very fascinating thing. We'll hold that for a second. But there is one additional point over here which I think is really fascinating. Why is the Chevron? Why Chevron of all places? You know, go to Shechem, go to Beit El. Go, there's lots of other places you could go. David HaMelech, God became a king in Chevron. So he's using, almost as if he's recreating the same platform of leadership like David HaMelech did for himself now. He's restarting that. And David HaMelech, by the way, as much as David HaMelech doesn't necessarily embrace him, he trusts him. Do you see that?
No.
So David HaMelech says, go ahead. No problem. And in fact, listen to how sad this is. Let's go to the next section. Yud to Yud Beis, and this is the end of our section for today. Vayishlach Avshalom meraglim b'chol shivtei Yisrael emor. When you hear the call, this is going to be the roll call for my cause. Then all scream out, "Avshalom is king." He had 200 men accompanying him from Yerushalayim going down south to Hebron. They were called, they were walking innocently with him. Vilayadu called David, didn't know anything. Vayishlach Avshalom el Achitofel Agiloni, Yoetz David Meir Gilo, Hagilo, he goes and gets one of David's trusted advisors, Achitofel, from Gilo, and he brings him with him. And everybody starts swelling. There's this great swell towards Avshalom. And this is now the beginning of the uprising against David HaMelech. So a few things over here. And Rashi has a really remarkable point. It's a sad reality. You remember he says, David, can I go to Hebron? Why does he just, just go to Hebron? Do what you want. After all, you're about to rebel. So why do you need to have the king saying, go ahead, my boy? Right? Why does he need that? So Rashi says a sad thing. Quoting in the Gemara, this is in Source 51, he says, Korim lo halchim l'sumam, furash b'mesecha sota Yerushalmi, he quotes the Yerushalmi in Sota, shebikesh ma'aviv shiyichtav loy, shekol shnei b'nei adam shivakesh yelchu imoy, yelchu. He said, look, he asked for a permission slip from his father to write with the signet of the king that if he asked for an accompanying two officers, he could use it for the people should accompany him. What do? He'd recruit a whole bunch of officers, each with the same letter. And he said, the king said, I can have an escort. So, you and you and you and you and you and you. And by the end of the day, he had 200 of the king's escort. Now, if you were to ask them, are you listening to the king? They'd say, absolutely. The king, I read it with my own eyes. I saw the king's own signet on it. What Avshalom do is once again corrupting the king's words. This is what he's able to do over here. Very, 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 very dangerous kind of way of looking at this. In fact, that this is what the Radak says as well, is that he pretended to them as if they were doing the right thing. Now, the next person, so those are he recruits these officers. He must be obviously of the royal guard, and then he now brings in Achitofel. Why Achitofel of all people? I mean, he happens to be an advisor of the king. He feels that Achitofel is also, is going to have his ear more than he would the allegiance to the king. Why Achitofel of all people? So the truth is, we need to remember his relationships. We need to remember who Achitofel is. Let's take a quick look. Shmuel Beis Perek Yud Aleph, Apostle Gimel, we know, Vayishlach David Vayidrosh Layishah, David Melech sees a woman who is bathing, and he said, tries to work out who she is. Vayomer Haloze Bas Sheva Bas Eliam Eshes Uriah Achiti. She's Bas Sheva. We always focus on her husband, who is Uriah, but who was her father's name. His name was Eliam. If you go to the end of Shmuel Beis, Perakov Gimel, we're told who Eliam is. Elifelet ben Ach Savai ben Aben Amachasi. Eliam ben Achitofel Hagiloni. Eliam was the son of Achitofel, which means that Achitofel is the grandfather of Bas Sheva. Which means to say, when Avshalom chooses a person who is going to defect, he's going to choose the person who he knows harbors animosity to the king. Because deep down inside, he still feels that his granddaughter was abused by this king. Whether or not David HaMelech was vindicated in public or not, he knows that there's a debt to settle in Achitofel's own heart. And this leads us to a very fascinating thing to close this section here. And that is, as one of the most successful aspects of who Avshalom is a person who is able to use other people's weaknesses against them and bring them into his own scheme to do his dirty work. If you think about this for a moment, what happened when he killed Amnon? Did he kill his own half-brother? No! He got somebody else to do the dirty work, and then he said to them, if they question you, it's me. Right? Every stage of the way. Who burnt the field of Yoav? It wasn't him. He turned to the servants. When it came to the rebellion, he has now the king's guard using the king's signet against the king to contract them. When he turns to Achitofel, it's not just because Achitofel is the best advisor in town, it's because Achitofel has a debt. He's got a burden that he's carrying. So therefore, he's able to corrupt all of these people into his cause. This is a very dangerous person. That's the sign of a very dangerous person. There are some people who are dangerous independently. Okay, you can neutralize such people. But people who are able to stir the pot in such a way are much more terrifying. And that's one of the things we're seeing about this, about Avshalom. What this leaves us over here is, this is a natural stopping point, because now we're going to see David HaMelech's reaction to the rebellion and the nobility of David versus the ignobility of Avshalom and his cohort. So David HaMelech was...